Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Our topic this hour is rebuilding sustainable, fire-resilient communities in the North Bay. This month's devastating wildfires have claimed over 40 lives and nearly 9,000 structures. The estimated damage to insured property exceeds $1 billion, and countless lives have been changed forever. The majority of the fires are now contained, but scientists predict further increases in large wildfires in the future as the climate warms and our region continues to grow into fire-prone areas. With rising temperatures, wildfire season has progressively grown longer over the last 40 years, and that trend is expected to continue. Now, as businesses reopen and people return to their neighborhoods, the North Bay looks ahead to recovery, cleanup, and rebuilding. Tonight on our program, we ask, what is being done to ensure future fire preparedness in our communities? How do we reduce the risk of devastating fires at the wildland-urban interface? What role does water management and infrastructure play in creating sustainable, fire-resilient communities? And how can you prevent fire damage to your home and community now? Joining me to discuss these issues are Dr. Nusha Ajami, the Director of Urban Water Policy with Stanford University's Water in the West and NSF Renewit Initiatives, an organization dedicated to creating safe, sustainable urban water infrastructures. And we're also joined by Jack Cohen, a retired research physical fire scientist with the USDA Forest Service. Cohen is the preeminent researcher on wildfire and home ignitions and a founder of the FireWise Communities USA Recognition Program. And we're also joined for the first half hour of this program by James Lee Witt, former director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, in the Clinton administration, and newly named interim executive director of Rebuild North Bay, a nonprofit organization formed to coordinate wildfire recovery in the region. And we invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation, and there are lots of ways to reach us. You can call us on our toll-free line, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, and we'll open the phone lines in just about 20 minutes. You can also email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also send a tweet to us at cityvisionskalw. So, Jack Cohen, let me begin with you. I wanted to just introduce some of the facts around the wildfires. And first, I wanted to ask you what we know about the conditions that predispose to wildfires and why the wildfires in the North Bay were so particularly devastating.
Well, we've got the fuel. Where it burned was a location that hadn't burned in quite some time. So, for example, 2 years ago, the Valley Fire burned just north of there in the Clear Lake area, and for the same reasons. We had the vegetation that was available, the dry conditions, the weather system that was produced very low relative humidity, as well as the strong winds. And when you've got that kind of thing, you're going to have extreme fire behavior.
And Dr. Ajami, I wanted to ask you what role climate change you think is playing in perpetuating these kinds of fires.
You know, we are having warmer temperature, experiencing warmer temperatures and extreme actually weather. So from lots of rainfall that we got this winter leading to a lot of vegetation that ended up drying much faster than expected and basically providing a fuel to the fire. You know, definitely climate change has impacted our hydrological patterns and climate patterns, and that is leading to experiences that we have not have had before, and we are not really equipped to deal with them unless we think differently about them.
And James Lee Witt, I know we have you for just about 30 minutes, so I'm going to ask you just a series of questions while we've got you. I know that you're very busy coordinating a lot of the recovery efforts up there. You've been involved in managing or have been consulted on over 400 disasters across the country, including the Northridge earthquake down in Los Angeles, hurricanes Katrina and Sandy. Can you tell us what are the different phases that communities go through when responding to disaster, as we're seeing right now in the North Bay?
Well, you know, the first thing that you see is a lot of shock, and then you see frustration, then you see anger, and I hope that doesn't escalate to that. You know, I was out there in the Malibu fires and the Laguna Beach fire, and you know, and the mudslides, and you know, it's really important that as we look at rebuilding, it's really important to look at how we can build back better, safer, with more resilience. And I never will forget Governor Pete Wilson and I was in the Laguna Beach fire, and every house up there had burned except one. And they had used clay tile roof with the 4-foot overhang on the sides of the home with more fire-retardant siding and more fire-retardant shrubbery around the home, and the guy was still living there. So there's an opportunity here to build back better and safer. And I was in Oakland, and yeah, I don't know if you remember the Oakland fire, but that neighborhood built back more fire-retardant, more resiliency, and it was amazing what they did in building back. So I think North Bay has a chance to build back better and safer, and I hope that we can lead that effort in towards doing that.
So it sounds like there's a real opportunity here. And you mentioned some of the emotional phases that people go through in these kinds of recoveries, and I imagine there's also some kind of organizational-type phases. Can you give us a sense of what phase of recovery the North Bay is in right now and what the needs are at this time?
Well, you know, they're starting to look at how, okay, they're, you know, looking at engineering, and they're looking at developers and trying to put together different phases of how they want their community to build back. And I think, you know, next week I'll be out there, and we hope that we can help them to decide in how they build, because this is really, really important, and it's a great opportunity for them to be more resilient in the future, because global climate change is here, whether people believe it or not, and we just need to address it, and we need to build back better. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you're coming out as an interim executive director, as I mentioned in the intro, for Rebuild North Bay, this new nonprofit. Can you tell us a little bit about that effort, who's involved, what the goals are, and what some of the resources are that the organization is bringing to the challenge here?
Well, there's a lot of people involved in it, and Darris Anderson is leading the effort, and they're selecting a big board that's going to approve or disapprove any of the areas that they want to focus on. But next week we're going to be focusing on meeting with the local elected officials and seeing what the voids are and determining what the nonprofit organization can help fill those voids, because, you know, you have FEMA funds, you have HUD, you have SBA, and many other federal streams, and Cal OES. And it's going to be important that we try to help fill those voids that's going to make it better and safer, and helping those families that's lost everything.
And so what are you going to be your priorities when you come out here and start getting involved in this? What are the priority action items that you want to start to work on?
Well, I think some of the most important things is right now is temporary housing. I know a lot of people in motels and hotels, and, you know, that can only last so long. And then you want to make sure that you don't lose all your workers, and make sure that you can have something that is sustainable and that people can live there and continue their lives. And then develop a short-term plan and a long-term plan that's going to be consistent with what the local community wants and local leaders want.
And how will local community members have a voice in this discussion? How is their voice going to be heard at the table?
Well, what we're planning on doing is to meet individually with all the local community leaders and elected officials, and to see where they're at, what their plans are, and to meet with the architects and engineers, and helping them to put out the best information and guiding those communities in how they can build back better.
Mm-hmm. And what are the usual factors that we have to take into account when we're looking at recovery and rebuilding? Does it often require new legislation at the federal, state, or local level? Is that something that you often see as a need in these kinds of situations?
Well, you know, California has some of the best building codes in the country, you know, for fire as well as earthquakes. And I think that those codes and enforcement of those codes are going to be important, but it might be that depending on the local communities and the individuals and local officials in how they want to build back. And so we'll be meeting with all of them and trying to determine how we can fulfill the obligations that we need to do to help them to accomplish that.
And are there pretty common barriers that you've seen dealing with all the different disasters that you've been involved with that that pose the rebuilding effort, or the things that we should sort of be on the lookout in the North Bay for common barriers to getting the region back on its feet?
Yeah, you know, when I was out there last week, you know, some of the barriers right now is EPA's on the ground to remove hazardous material. And then they've got a very ambitious program in place, Mark Galladucci with Cal OES, in removing the rest of the debris. But, you know, the EPA has to remove the hazardous material first and then get the rest of the debris out of the way so that realistically people can start focusing on rebuilding and getting their lives back together.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like some coordination then with other government agencies. Also wondering if there are some lessons that we can learn from other disasters, other regions that have gone through similar kinds of issues. I mean, you mentioned the fires down in Malibu and how that really exposed the need for better roofing material, maybe some other building standards. Are there other lessons that we can draw in going forward now in the North Bay?
I think so. I think it's really going to be important that the research that's been done on fire safety and how to build back better with more fire resistance is going to be important in the decision-making process. And there's a lot of information available, and I know you've got some good people on the phone now that has a lot of experience in that research area. So I think that's going to could add a tremendous value to how they build back.
Mm-hmm. And I definitely want to get to our other experts, and just since you need to leave at half past, I want to make sure that we can get as much information out of you for our listeners as we can. Just one other question before I go to those other guests. Wondering what discussion there is around the urban sprawl challenge, and if you think that these kinds of disasters, particularly the wildfires, really expose the need for greater land use controls over how we develop into these fire-prone areas.
Well, I think it has to be looked at. You know, one of the things that I'm concerned about right now is I know you start getting into the rainy season right now, and all those areas that's been burnt needs to be seeded and mulched and try to stabilize some of the environmental runoff that's going to happen, and that's going to be very important. But I think that you have to look at the area, you have to look at the risk, and then you have to try to minimize that risk in how you build.
Great. Well, thank you, James Lee Witt, for these comments. Please do stay on the line. I want to talk to the other panelists, and then we're going to open the phone lines at 7:20. So for listeners who have questions for Mr. Witt, now's the time to get those ready for us, and feel free to email or call or tweet those into us now. And I want to talk to Jack Cohen. Thank you for standing by while we were talking to Mr. Witt for a while there. About his comments, Mr. Witt's comments, see if you had any reactions to those. But also to ask you just generally how wildfires kind of play out in our natural ecosystem. I mean, we know we've had wildfires here in a Mediterranean climate, you know, for thousands of years. And what is the sort of natural role that these wildfires play?
Well, I think the main point to make is, first of all, that wildfires are inevitable, and that's today. With regard to the past, I think the important point to realize is that fires were burning whenever they could burn. They were ignited by people as the ice sheets retreated post-Pleistocene and the vegetation redeveloped into what we had when European settlers arrived. That development of the vegetation, the ecosystems, was very much with fire as one of the disturbance factors. And so we need to get the idea that, one, we need to be compatible, and two, that the reduction in the amount of fire that has occurred and only burning during extreme conditions that we could not control the wildfires has actually changed our landscape and towards a direction of actually more extreme fire behavior when it occurs and more extensive fire occurrence, larger areas. And all of that exposes the development that we've got and any development that would be coming into the future. So the idea here is not to try to eliminate fire, and because we can't, 2% of the time is when our fire suppression of wildfires fails, and this is the time when the wildland urban fire disasters are occurring. We need to basically, and this sounds counterintuitive, to actually increase fire, but not in a, well, in a proactive way, but not under the extreme conditions that are occurring.
So I know we've had a long-standing policy of suppressing wildfires in this country, and that has led to a buildup of a lot of essentially vegetable type matter, vegetation that can burn very hot. How do we light fires now? How do we do controlled burns in a way that doesn't let these fires get out of hand?
Well, so one of the things that we need to recognize is that right now the fires that are occurring are under the extreme conditions, and our attitude is largely molded by the disastrous fire occurrence rather than fires that would occur under prescribed conditions, both prescribed as in terms of the area that's ignited, but also the conditions would be more moderate instead of extreme, which limits the amount of smoke production from an area because not as much material is burning. And plus, we can allow the fires to burn during more moderate conditions where there is short episodes of conditions that are a bit more severe that allows us to burn larger areas. But let me point out that one of the major impediments for us being able to do that, beyond just our attitude towards fire, is the threat to residential development, the threat to our built environment. Wherein lies our opportunity is in the recognition that the ignitions on structures, homes igniting during extreme conditions, is very much a very local set of conditions. So it's not so much the direct influence of the very large fires that gather our attention and impress us. It's very much the conditions that meet the requirements for combustion, very, very local to the house. This offers us opportunities to change the ignitability of our houses such that we aren't so vulnerable, so that we don't have simultaneous structures igniting throughout broad areas of development.
So I'm surprised that the big barrier is concern from the neighbors and not so much money. It seems like often it's resources. So is the resources to do this kind of work not really the issue then?
Are you talking about prescribed burning?
Yes.
Or are you talking about fire suppression?
Oh, sorry, for prescribed burning.
Well, I would suggest that we, as agencies and also the public, really don't support the proaction that is required in order to do prescribed burning. Because of our high risk aversion, we aren't really supporting prescribed burning at a level that would make significant ecological and landscape changes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of perhaps the ironies is that we are very much held accountable for doing prescribed burning, and in fact we're urged to call them control burns, but the reality is if we do it on a landscape significant level, we're not going to be able to explicitly control the perimeter on these fires.
Mm-hmm.
But we can prescribe the time and the location for doing the burning with the recognition that future wildfires are inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
So we're held accountable for our proaction, but we're not held accountable for our failure.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an imbalance of responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So some education of the public sounds like might be in order then to counteract this. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing how to rebuild sustainable fire-resilient communities in the North Bay, and we're joined by Dr. Nusha Ajami, Director of Urban Water Policy with Stanford University's Water in the West and NSF Renew It Initiatives. Jack Cohen, now retired research physical fire scientist with the USDA Forest Service, and James Lee Witt, former director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, in the Clinton administration, and newly named interim executive director of Rebuild North Bay. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments, and we're opening the phone lines now. Have you been personally impacted by the North Bay fires? If so, what do you think the most important aspects of fire preparedness are? How should we address rebuilding in the setting of climate change? The toll-free number to call to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. Let's go to the phone lines right now. We have Karen in Berkeley. Karen, welcome to City Visions. Hi, Karen. Looks like we may have lost Karen, so let's go to another caller. We have Nikki in San Francisco. Nikki, welcome to City Visions.
Hi there. Thanks for doing this show. I have two questions, two big concerns. When there were the fires up in the North Bay, I was very nervous about Mount Tam. And so my first question is, what can be done to protect Mount Tam? And I know people may be resistant to the controlled burns, but I just want to hear what your guests would say about protecting Mount Tam. And then my second question for San Francisco, you know, we have an urban environment that's very high risk after an earthquake, for example, when there aren't enough fire engines to go around. And, of course, there's NERT that tells a small fraction of us how to turn off the gas if we see the meter going crazy and smelling a leak. But can you comment on both of those things?
Sure. Well, maybe why don't we have James Lee Witt comment on that second part of the question there about what people in urban environments can do to protect themselves. So, Mr. Witt, if you wanted to weigh in on that.
Well, of course, if you're in an earthquake risk area, then, of course, you know, one of the most important things is to have a particular gas meters that has an automatic shutoff valve. If that's available, which there is a lot of those available. And, I read the book on the big fire in San Francisco, which was quite extensive. And I think also that, you know, in Northridge earthquake, we saw a tremendous amount of homes that were built before there were seismic building codes. And actually, there was 5,000 homes that we basically anchored to the foundations that were not anchored to the foundations. And I know when First Lady Hillary Clinton was out there, we were in this one neighborhood, historical neighborhood, and all the homes had shifted south because that was a rolling earthquake. And there was one house that this guy was still living in, had zero damage. And I asked him, I said, "What did you do?" He said, "I went to the county library and I checked out a FEMA OES book on how to retrofit your house for earthquakes, and I did it myself, and I spent $1,000, and he was still living in his home."
Mm-hmm. So thank you for that response. And then, Nikki, you also had a question about protecting Mount Tam, and Jack Cohen, did you want to respond to that part of the question?
You know, I'm not familiar enough with what the issues are, both the vegetation as well as whatever other values there would be, and so I don't really think that I'm qualified to make a comment.
Okay, all right. Well, I appreciate the honesty there, and Nikki, we'll see if we can get you some more resources to address that question, and maybe if you keep listening, we'll talk about some similar places and hopefully get some insight that way. But thank you for calling in. I did get a question on our Facebook page that asks, are there more specific standards that need to be written into the fire code to enable both local jurisdictions and fire agencies to set hard and fast rules to address fire safety concerns like access roads, fire clearance, and building material standards? And even better, can these standards be made more mandatory? And the question went on to describe how sometimes these, there's a little bit of squishy leeway here, and housing developers aren't always necessarily adhering to the most strict standards, and locals may have reasons to want to opt out. So, James Lee Witt, have you thought about how that we might be able to make these more mandatory, or ways to improve the standards in the fire code?
Well, I think if California has some very good fire codes, and I think if people enforce those codes and comply with them, I think that would be of a tremendous help. I know in the Malibu fires, the problem we had up there was that it was on the side of the mountain, and people kept building above the other person in front of them to see the ocean, but they never broadened the roads going up to the structures, to the homes, and the fire trucks had difficulty getting in there. It's a little bit different in North Bay. You know, there's very good access, but this fire moved so fast and so quick, it was difficult to contain it.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go back to the phone lines with Lisa from Berkeley. Lisa, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. Thanks for having this show. The one thing I'm finding very frustrating about the coverage of the fires in the North Bay is the fact that nobody's bringing up the fact that we've cut down 99% of our protection from fires. Redwoods are resistant to fires. They keep down the detritus underneath them. They prevent fires. And you can see redwoods that are thousands of years old with burns on them, because it doesn't kill them. And they also bring in moisture from the ocean and hold it in the land. And then they also transpire our water into the air. And we have cut down 99% of them from the coast of Oregon all the way down to Big Sur and about 40, 50 miles in. And nobody is talking about the effect of that on these fires.
So, Jack Cohen, I want to let you weigh in, and I know Nusha Jami is standing by, too. We want to get to some water issues. But, Jack Cohen, do you have a response to this idea that clear-cutting our redwood trees has had an impact on our fire resistance and our landscape?
Well, it's been my experience during the events that produce these disasters that we have strong winds that have very low relative humidity, and in those particular cases, there is, and the turbulent mixing that occurs in those cases, that the transpiration is negligible into the atmosphere. So basically what we're talking about is, one, the strong winds, which in particular will help loft burning embers downwind to generate more ignitions, and the extremely low relative humidities pretty much overwhelm the transpiration that's possible. Plus, the time of the year that it occurs is in the dry time, when it's typically dry anyway, and the trees and the vegetation typically limits the amount of transpiration that can occur under those conditions. So I would agree, under calm conditions and certainly under the moderate conditions, but not during a strong Diablo wind like that occurred.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Lisa, for that question. Let's go back to the phones. Christopher from San Francisco, welcome to City Visions. Christopher, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great.
And
welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I am a longtime listener and volunteer and supporter of PALW, and I love the program.
Great.
Just briefly, I'm a 25-year-long transplant from western Pennsylvania in the deep woods there, and I understand very much how nature works as far as burning and regrowth and all of that. And I am concerned, I hear so much commentary from people with the perspective of property owners and vineyard owners and people of those interests, but let's not forget, there's only so much we can do to protect from how Mother Nature works.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just work on working within the boundaries and within how Mother Nature works. We cannot control this.
Mm-hmm.
We can only do so much to protect ourselves from it, and that includes not building in areas that are fire prone and reducing that risk. And that's my general comment.
Well, no,
thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thank you, Christopher, first of all, for your support for the station and the program, but also for that comment. James Lee Witt, I know you have to leave in just a minute. I'm sure you hear sentiments like that expressed when these disasters happen. What's your response?
Well, you know, people need to realize where they're building, what those risks are, and then try to minimize that risk as much as possible. And, you know, they talk about prescribed burns or control burns. I think at the right times of year when there's moisture and when they can control the burns, then I think that's very extremely helpful and to minimize the effects of future wildfires. It was so funny in the Laguna Beach fires. Later, some of the landowners up there actually hired a guy with goats to eat the underbrush around the side of the mountain so that they would have less fuel for fires to ignite. And, you know, and when I was director of FEMA, I've tried to get the U.S. Forest Service and us partner on like a dead fuel removal program, which I still think would be extremely helpful in a lot of the areas. And, you know, and I think we should look at that in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Christopher, for that question, and also James DeWitt for joining us. I know you have to leave, but we hope to include you in future discussions on this, and we wish you best of luck with the new nonprofit Rebuild North Bay and all those efforts to try to get that region of the area back up on its feet. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight we're discussing how to rebuild sustainable, fire-resilient communities in the North Bay with our guests, Dr. Nusha Jami, Director of Urban Water Policy with Stanford University's Water in the West and NSF Renew It Initiatives, Jack Cohen, retired research physical fire scientist with the USDA Forest Service, and we were just joined by James Lee Witt, former director of FEMA in the Clinton administration and newly named interim executive director of Rebuild North Bay. We'd like to take your questions and comments, and the toll-free number to call to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. Now, I want to go to Dr. Nusha Jami. Thank you so much, first of all, for your patience. We spent a long time there in the first half with James Lee Witt and also with Jack Cohen, but I want to work you into this conversation. I appreciate you standing by and ask about the role of water management and infrastructure when it comes to these issues. And first of all, how will climate change and future cycles of drought and heavy rain be impacting wildfires like this going forward?
So, you know, this was a devastating disaster that happened in North Bay, and but you know, sometimes with these disasters comes an opportunity to rethink the way we rebuild our community. And North Bay actually heavily segments of their water supply actually comes from groundwater, and as they are rebuilding these communities, they have to rethink how they would like to have a community that works with nature. So when we have future rains and storms, we have kind of an infrastructure such as green infrastructure that can allow for the water to infiltrate to the groundwater basins and recharge those groundwater basins, and also create spaces that are allows us to work with nature. I actually agree with your last caller who mentioned, you know, we have to learn how to live with nature rather than trying to control it. And, you know, this is an opportunity for the North Bay to have, you know, roads that have less impervious areas, allowing for the water to flow, allowing for the water to stay clean, And another thing I wanted to mention, actually, is I think active forest management is really key, and I know one of your guests mentioned this. You know, that can prevent disastrous fires, and also can prevent the cities to be impacted as part of this sort of fire disasters that we are experiencing here. So, and there is a lack of funding for that process, unfortunately, partly because there's so many other things to deal with, and it's at the end of the list, but it has to become a priority, because as people build these infrastructures and homes and communities close to forest areas, we have to be able to manage them in a way that they would help us with actively protecting our water supplies, actually, and also prevent disastrous fires that we have a hard time managing.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned a number of solutions there, I mean, obviously the active forest management that you and Jack Cohen have just been talking about, but also allowing more of the water to sort of be able to be recharging into the groundwater system. What are some of the other barriers besides money that is preventing this kind of infrastructure deployment and the kind of building we need to allow this water, better water management to happen?
So, you know, the cities that we have right now, most of them have been built in the past few centuries. The mindset around them were, you know, we were constantly trying to control the nature. So how can we capture the stormwater and send it outside of the city and the community as fast as we can? More and more we are realizing, actually, the water that comes as rain is actually a clean water that we can potentially, with a very easy purification, make it into a water supply. So we should not be actually trying to get rid of it. We should try to capture it and use it and reuse it as a supply source. So, but having said that, as we are realizing this in this century, our cities and communities have been built in the previous century, which was not the mindset wasn't that. Mm-hmm. So it is very, very difficult to introduce some of these kind of infrastructure when you have an existing built environment. We need to create space for them. But, you know, again, while it was devastating what happened in North Bay, they now have a clean sheet of paper that they can draw their cities and build them to the 21st century standards. So it's good to actually embrace some of these 21st century solutions for them. And that makes them more resilient as well.
And are there any cities in the United States that present good models for the North Bay to learn from and to replicate in terms of water management?
Yeah, absolutely. D.C. just recently started introducing green infrastructure in their community. Their goal was to prevent or improve the water quality and prevent some of the water quality challenges they were having. Philadelphia has been introducing a lot of green infrastructure. Close to home, San Francisco has been working on a green infrastructure plan. And they have been implementing some of these solutions in the city to avoid urban flooding and also capture the stormwater, which eventually can, as I said, recharge our groundwater basins. So there are a lot of models out there. There's a lot, while the topic of green infrastructure is not new, it's becoming much more popular right now, and there's so much information out there for these communities to work with and make sure they can take advantage of them.
Yeah, sounds like some good models for the area. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Inger from San Francisco. Inger, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thank you. So we had a house in Santa Rosa, Northeast Santa Rosa, that was our vacation home just off Mark West Springs near the Fountain Grove development in a kind of a more rural area with bigger lots, and it burned to the ground, as did pretty much every other home around us. And so I have questions about, you know, more about sort of the building materials used in building the house, because we're starting to think about rebuilding. I mean, it's early days, and first debris removal has to happen, but just to give myself something pleasant to think about, I'm starting to think about rebuilding. And so I have two questions. So first, I'm curious, in this particular fire, the Tubbs fire, which just blew through our neighborhood, I'm just curious if building materials would have even made a difference, you know, because I just went back on Friday and saw the remains of our house, and from what I saw, it just looked like I can't imagine anything surviving that sort of fire. And then secondly, you know, looking to the future and rebuilding, you know, for us, since we're not in like a coffee park type development, we're, you know, I don't think we're going to be part of some like, you know, city development or larger development plan. We're kind of going to be on our own rebuilding, and I'm just wondering where I find resources to help me figure out, you know, how am I going to rebuild my home here on our property.
Mm-hmm. Well, Inger, thank you for calling in with that question. I'm sorry about your home and what you're going through to have to rebuild it. Jack Cohen, did you want to respond to those questions about building material and resources for rebuilding?
Yeah, one of the things that I want to point out, and this is evident in the multitude of photos that came out of all of the fires, not only recently, but all the past disasters that I've investigated, what I find over and over again are totally destroyed houses with adjacent unconsumed vegetation in the area. So what that's telling us, and this is even particularly true of the fire that James Lee Witt was talking about in Laguna, in the Laguna area, there were block after block of totally destroyed houses with still unconsumed vegetation between the streets and the houses. And so what I want to point out here is the very, very local conditions that are responsible for the ignitions of the house. So what I'm saying here is that the total destruction is not a function of this huge, intense, direct tsunami flame of coming through the neighborhood. What's happening is that it's primarily the little things. Now, I'm not saying that if you are living with tree canopy, continuous tree canopy surrounding you, and a continuous high-intensity crown fire burns through, that somehow you're going to be okay. But what I am saying is that if those flames are as little as 100 feet away from your house, that the direct flame heat transfer is not sufficient to ignite the structure. So what that says from the investigations and the experimental research that I've done indicates that it's very local to the house. It's the mulch that you've got that's contacting the house that then ignites the house sustainably. And one of the key factors in these disasters is that there are many, many more houses exposed to ignition than there are firefighters to protect all of these houses. So when we talk about bridge loads and road widths and all of this access, it really doesn't matter, because frequently there are 10 houses, 20 houses, 25 houses for every engine that is available. So what happens is that the houses are exposed to typically small ignitions that go unattended. People have been evacuated. Firefighters are too few in order to protect all the exposed houses, principally due to burning embers lofted out of the wildfire. The wildfire may never even get into the community. It stops at the edge of the community, but the firebrands are landing all over the community and igniting vegetation between houses and directly igniting debris as well as the houses directly. And so what's happening is that we have houses that are freely burning to total destruction from small ignitions. So it's not this huge tsunami of flame that's causing the problem. The problem is can be as simple as pine needles in the rain gutters, or firewood that's leaning up against the house, or dry cured grass that goes right to the edge of the wood walls. And it's not necessarily the wood walls that are the problem if you don't have flame contact. Well, so on your property, you don't have to necessarily eliminate all fire. You just have to eliminate the high-intensity canopy fire from shrubs and trees within 100 feet, and then not have fire contacting the structure. And that can be as simple as making sure that your grass is mowed short and not having anything that can burn within 5 feet of the structure. And then look for debris in the rain gutters and on the decks and things like that. So these are all factors that are readily mitigated, and it doesn't depend, the survival of your house doesn't depend on controlling the uncontrolled wildfire. Our control of nature approach is not working. It's clearly not working. I agree with the caller that it's not working, and yet we've got alternatives that are actually more effective than our very expensive fire suppression and protection.
And Jack, lots of helpful tips there, I think, for people. And just really quickly, do you have a response to Inger about resources for rebuilding? If you just have a minute to respond to that while I go to station.
From that, I do not know.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Inger, for calling in, and Jack, for those responses. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing how to rebuild sustainable, fire-resilient communities in the North Bay. We're joined by Dr. Nusha Ajami from Stanford University's Water in the West and NSF Renew It Initiatives, and Jack Cohen, now retired research physical fire scientist with the USDA Forest Service. And we still invite you to call in with questions or comments. The number to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Luke from Point Reyes Station. Luke, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thanks a lot. I'm just curious if there is any sort of fire retardant sealant that is on the market that you could put on your house, or is that something that they're even working on, like retrofitting your house for an earthquake? Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the question, Luke. So a fire retardant kind of sealant that you could put on your home. Let's see, Jack Cohen, are you aware of any preventative measures like that?
Well, let me say that typically those kinds of materials are applied to some of the least vulnerable parts of the house. We tend to look at walls as being the typical problem, a wood wall, for example, and it is the least, probably the least ignitable of all the materials. So what we need to do is to be aware and particularly strive to not have direct flame heating, such that both the radiant heat from the flames as well as no flame contact, which means that the only exposure to the house that would produce an ignition would be the burning embers, the shower of firebrands that we call the burning embers firebrands, that would be landing on the house. Mm-hmm. And so in obviously, we do not want to have a flammable wood roof on the structure. It would be the most vulnerable, and fire retardants that are put on it that would not be pressure treated tend to leach away in fairly short periods of time. So what I'm saying is that the best things we can do are the readily available products that are on the market. Let me quickly say that in response to the resources, I may have misunderstood. If we're talking about resources, recommended materials, I would strongly recommend starting with the firewise.org website, which has a great deal of information with regard to how to mitigate and also materials that you might build your house out of, as well as design that reduce the or produce ignition resistance of your house. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, thank you. Yes, Dr. Jemmy, I did want to ask you to respond to the question, too. I actually was curious if there are negative water pollution impacts from these kinds of materials, but it also sounds like you wanted to respond to the question, too. So please go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. That's where I wanted to go, which is, you know, if we actually do a proactive management of our environment, the way actually Dr. Cohen also talked about, is much more valuable to us and our environment and our resources than trying to put another chemical on our house, on our body, on our environment in different ways. While I know these fires are devastating and really, really, hurt a lot of people, but the reality is, some of these decisions that we make about using different kind of fire retardants or this chemical or that chemical can have long-term impacts on us and our children and our environment and our natural resources and our water. So I actually want to discourage people from thinking about fire management by looking for something like that, and I encourage them to think about how more actively they can be involved in preventing different kindlings that can exist around their homes that can create a devastating fire, or prevent them from being falling into flames, and avoid using going towards simple solutions that might not necessarily be in a long term beneficial to us.
Mm-hmm. And Nusha, on the subject of resources too, Jack had mentioned one of the website resources. Are there resources that you can tell people to look to when they're thinking about how to sort of environmentally, sustainably make their homes more fire resilient and maybe avoid some of these chemicals and the fire retardants, things like that?
So I do not have any, I don't know any websites that can help with the fire sort of resilient homes for like material for fire resilient homes, but I really do encourage everyone to look at state water board or regional water board's website. They do actually highlight a lot of different chemicals that can be in different materials and end up in our water bodies and eventually hurts us and our environment and our ecosystem. And I encourage everyone to look into that. There is lots of efforts right now going on to sort of get rid of some of these chemicals and eliminate them from our environment, which is very, very difficult. That's why it's better to prevent them to not introduce them rather than trying to get them out from the environment.
And actually, on this subject, we have a comment from Jeff in El Cerrito who asked, does plastics and furniture and electronics contribute to the ferocity of the fire, and does this shorten the time we have to respond to the fire? He says the El Cerrito Fire Department has said that there is less time to evacuate. So I guess, Nusha, question for you in terms of the pollution impacts from things like plastics and the fires. How do we manage that in terms of water quality? And then, Jack Cohen, I want to go to you to ask about whether or not it contributes to the ferocity. But, Nusha, let's start with you.
I mean, there was a big concern right after these fires of how we want to prevent some of these pollutants and toxins to end up in our water systems. And I know various organizations right now in the North Bay working, I think Jim also mentioned that they're trying to kind of create some sort of barriers for some of these ashes and remainings of the fire to sort of flow into our water systems. Obviously, there's so much toxins in our homes that when they burn down, they are basically they can be flown to the river system as soon as we start having next rainy season. Or actually, we actually have some rains last week, which there was a lot of effort to prevent that causing some pollution in the water system. So it's an active effort that we are all sort of undertaking to make sure we can protect our resources, as I mentioned earlier, Sal, the goal is to prevent the sources from getting polluted. Mm-hmm. And every single one of us can contribute in that process, it's better for all of us.
Mm-hmm. And Jack Cohen, I also wanted to get you to weigh in. Is it true that plastics contribute to the ferocity of fires?
Well, They can, and let me just briefly explain, for example, the difference between wood burning and anaplastic burning. So with wood, basically, it's a very low conductivity material, so by and large, the chemical decomposition that produces the flammable vapors that supports the flaming combustion is on the very outside of that wood material, which means that the wood, the rate of combustion is actually slowed down by this thermal front having to go into the into a very low conductivity material. What happens with plastics is that it melts rather quickly and at much lower temperatures than what it takes to decompose the wood, and that liquefies and allows a more rapid vaporization, which then supports the fire, which would increase the rate of combustion due to plastics. But one of the things that I want to mention is that many of our plastics have carbon-nitrogen chains in them, as well as halogens like chlorine, in which case we end up with toxic gases coming off and toxic residues. And I couldn't agree more.
That's a whole other public health and health and safety challenge there with those toxic. We just have a few minutes left, and I want to get to a caller who's been standing by, Liz Simba from Oakland. We only have a couple minutes, but real briefly, welcome to City Visions, and do you have a quick question for our panel?
Yes, thank you for having me. Lovely conversation you guys are having, and I find it kind of curious that here with global warming and the constant massive disasters that are happening, that it doesn't seem to be very much of a proactive approach for high density or environmentally vulnerable areas to put in a large scale plan that when incidents do happen. It seems always to be very reactionary and very much ends up relying on the fact if people have availability to electricity, cell phones, computer, the information on hand that is then at that very moment during the crisis being extrapolated to everybody. I just wanted to know your thoughts about maybe take, I don't know.
I think it's a really important question to ask, and actually a nice one to conclude on. And Dr. Ajami, let me give you the last word here. What can we do to be better about preparing for these disasters so we're not just reacting?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. We are often reactive rather than proactive, and partly is because of the resources. We have limited resources, so many things to deal with, and sometimes some of these issues fall off the priority list, such as forest management, such as protecting infrastructure, such as also land use management, which is extremely important, and you brought it up earlier in the show as well. Unfortunately, again, it needs to be proactive. We are not being proactive about it, and I think partially it's driven by the lack of resources and lack of human resources and financial resources that stops us from being a little bit better in planning.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to end the conversation there, but I think that's a good lesson for all of us taking away from this conversation about what's needed going forward in the wake of these disasters. So that's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Dr. Nusha Ajami, Director of Urban Water Policy with Stanford University's Water in the West, Jack Cohen, now retired research physical fire scientist with the USDA Forest Service, and earlier by James Lee Witt, former director of FEMA in the Clinton administration. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Please join us next week for a discussion of how California has been fighting the Trump administration 1 year since the 2016 presidential election. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.